I think if you have an interest in life, you have to pursue it. I'm a big believer in interest in life. As long as you're interested, you'll never stop getting better at a thing. So for me, it was about pursuing this interest I had. I knew I had a point of view that would add a bit of something to the market that wasn't already there. You know?
Hey, everybody. I'm Gary Fox, and this is The Entrepreneur Experiment. Thank you very much for listening. This week, I'm joined by Paul Galvin. Many of you will know Paul from his time as a Kerry footballer. Well, what you might not know is that he's a highly successful entrepreneur with his Go Dare brand, and you'll also know his range in Dunn Stores. So it's a fascinating chat. It's one of the most varied and rich chats I've had on The Entrepreneur Experiment, and it's a privilege to be joined by him. I certainly learned a lot, and I think you will too. This week, our episode is sponsored by Intercast, intercast.ie. Intercast help companies produce internal podcasts to keep in touch with their staff, inform them of what's happening, which is especially important during these tricky times where it's very difficult when a lot of people are dispersed all around the world and Ireland. So it's worth checking out. It's intercast.ie if you're looking to get a podcast produced for your company, for your employees. So that's it. Enjoy the episode. It's a really good chat and goes to a lot of interesting places. Enjoy. This is Paul Galvin on The Entrepreneur Experiment. Paul, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Gary. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Thanks for making the time.
No problem.
How's life going for you?
I didn't have a whole lot else on. You know?
I was going to ask you. We won't touch on the big C word too much. But how's life been treating you the last couple of months?
It's been okay from the point of view that, you know, I've been able to take stock. I think it's a kind of a unique time in many ways. If you can try and use the time to reflect and reboot and think about where you've been and where you're headed, I think it's an opportunity that you won't get again. I used it from that point of view in regards my own personal development, really, and kind of tuning into myself and listening to myself and asking myself some questions and deciding upon, you know, where next and what next, you know, that kind of thing. So aside from the whole, the stress and the suffering that families underwent, which was difficult, obviously, I tried as best I could to use the time as best I could.
Mm. And how did you do that? Because it's a really interesting, I'm fascinated by daily habits of people, daily habits of high performers, continually looking at people going, what are they doing? What does he do on a daily basis? So what did you do then to kind of make the use of the time?
I spent quite a good bit of time doing nothing at all. As in, I just felt I needed to kind of recalibrate myself and listen into myself. And that's very, very hard to do day to day when you're dealing with different departments, 100 emails, phone calls, social media, family. You get very little time to tune into your own kind of frequency and kind of listen to yourself. And so I was just checking my levels, really, you know, spending time obviously with my wife and our little daughter, who kept me very entertained and occupied. And watching her grow up was a big learning experience, honestly. You know, I actually learned quite a bit from her. I learned quite a bit about nature. She started to speak kind of properly in the few months, and all her words, nearly all her first words were nature-related words, and I see this effect nature has on her in terms of her personality. She gets, nature can kind of, she becomes overcome when she goes out into the grass and she's amongst kind of the plants and the trees and the flowers and the bees and that. So it was just a kind of an interesting time for me to, you know, check my levels in terms of where I'm at in my relationships with family and friends. How good a family, how good a brother and a sister and a friend am I? How good a father and a husband am I? Where my levels are at regards my courage and my ability to lead people, my self-confidence, and you know, am I being the best kind of version of myself that I can be? That's what I kind of spent most time on. I had a complete writer's block, so I wasn't able to do any writing. I could barely string a sentence together. So that gave me even more time to be reflecting. And
well, you took the next question. I was going to ask, like, is that a very unique process that I think very few people actually take the time to look at themselves. I was going to ask you, like, do you do that just mindfulness, journaling, meditation, or just being with yourself? How do you do it?
I don't mind. I've always been comfortable in my own company, you know, and I've always liked my own company. So the bit of solitude, I probably need it, because you don't get to spend time with yourself really a whole lot. And So I found that time valuable in some ways, whilst it was difficult in other ways. I did value the bit of solitude and silence and that. So I would have practiced meditation at times. I actually used this time to stop doing it, because I find it's a thing you have to find time for, and there's a time commitment with meditation. And over the last couple of months, I actually stopped doing it because I just wanted to decompress completely and just let the sediments settle at the bottom, if you get me. And so it was really just thinking and listening to a bit of silence and listening to myself a little bit. If that doesn't sound too kind of obscure.
No, look, I think everyone should have used this time in a different way. But as you're saying there about nature, it's mad to see nature come back, as in like just things growing out and, you know, the world going back to what it probably should be, you know, even in the back garden, just seeing things bloom out. And even as long as you're driving along the road, just things are starting to bloom out. Just far more animals and stuff around as well. Just taking the time to look around. You're always rushing. You're always rushing to work, rushing here, rushing there. You don't actually take your time to just like walk along and just look.
Yeah. I think there's a little bit of good energy in that. You know, if you can reconnect and kind of start to take stock of these things around you whilst you can. I really only did it through the eyes of my daughter, really, you know, and she was learning all these words and they were all nature related. So I began to tune in more and connect more probably with, we have a nice little garden here, and it's just, it was peaceful and it was interesting to observe her, observe nature, and observe the effect nature had on her. So look, it was all very Woodstock.
We've seen it through fresh eyes.
Very Woodstock. I begin to sound like, you know, a kind of a hippy dippy here, but anyway, that was kind of it. It was really quiet.
That's cool. And before COVID, then, what was your kind of day to day? What were you doing?
Well, with my main business with Dunn's, in terms of, I have it's like an agency service. My company is like an agency service, so it really is I consider it a form of publishing through men's clothing. So I have a company called Godia Creative. That's like I consider it a publishing company or a storytelling company. So we do two collections a year, and they're all really rooted in culture, meaning, masculinity, and meaningful design that tells a story about something or someone or an event or a book or an Olympics or a building or a piece of art or whatever it might be. We've touched on all sorts, from the national anthem to Samuel Beckett, to Olympics, to war, to history, to art. So that's the main business I deal day to day. I deal with the different departments in Dunn's, and there are many. It's a huge business in head office. There are over 700 people or so in there. So I would deal from day to day with the marketing people, the buyers, the design team, the brand planning people, the e-commerce people, the studio. Sometimes then the shareholders will keep in touch and connect over whatever it might be. I had a good chat with Padraig Harrington, actually my stable mate in Dunn's, over the COVID. That was the one thing I undertook as a kind of a project, was a Zoom chat for Dunn's, conversation between myself and Padraig Harrington, who has a business with Dunn's as well, about the relationship between design and sport and design and golf specifically. So that took a little bit of time up. But pre-COVID, it's menswear collections, design. My business is really design and marketing. It's a storytelling publishing business. So I'm across probably the copywriting, everything from the copywriting to the press releases and everything in between, from fits and fabrications to price points and all those conversations around building a brand with a big retailer like Dunn's, you know.
So you're super hands-on. I think that's interesting for people to know that it's not just your name. You know, you see some partnerships with high-profile people, and it just tends to be just the name. So it's interesting to see. I want to come back to that in a second. But how did this all start? How did the agency business start with you and Dunn's?
Well, I guess I go back 15 years, maybe 20 years. What age am I? Yeah, about 20 years, let's say. And I was always young. When I was younger, I was always interested in sports brands, sports people, people like Fred Perry, brands like Fred Perry, who was a sportsman, René Lacoste, Lacoste brand. He was another sportsman. Brands like Levi's and Carhartt, brands like Farah. So I was always interested in brands and the business of brands. And then I was discovered as I started to kind of read more and kind of research more, people like the Fred Perrys and the Stan Smiths and the René Lacostes, that these brands were based on actual sports people. And that started to capture my interest. So I started to observe the high street, really. I was probably going into shops that sold men's clothing for a good many years. And I just felt everything I saw, nothing I saw meant anything to me, really. You know what I mean? Especially on the high street. I felt there was a lack of meaning in terms of menswear. Whereas, especially in print, I'd look at lots of print shirts and I'd say, like, I'd see bananas or I'd see bloody flowers. And do you know what I mean? I think print storytelling is a big part of what I term print storytelling within what I do with Duns, where if you're going to put a print on the shirt, on a shirt or on a t-shirt, it should say something or mean something. So I just felt the high street was meaningless. And I figured, with my interest in brands and business from when I was quite young, I figured I was going to get into that business at some point in time, because there was nobody doing it in Ireland. There was nobody doing it. So I wrote a book. I wrote my own autobiography, and I spoke to some people in the fashion business, like a woman, Barbara Powers, the fashion editor at the Irish Independent. Spoke to her about what I wanted to do. She gave me some good advice. She suggested maybe Duns might be a good possible partnership, or what would I say, a conversation to be had. I had had Duns in my head, because the way I see Duns in the Irish cultural landscape, I see Duns as like this cultural institution. Like, I see the GAA as being like a cultural pillar in Ireland. And I see Duns as being the very same way. Mm. My sister worked with Duns when she was younger and put money in her pocket. So I felt with the way I was investigating culture and looking for meaning and exploring people like Samuel Beckett and the Walker brothers and Patrick O'Connell and Michael O'Connell and these Irish cultural figures, I figured Duns being a cultural institution would be a good place to maybe bring these stories to life.
And why did you choose to partner with someone as opposed to just starting yourself, going out on your own?
Yeah, I did, because I did have a look at going out on my own. And I mean, I figured, it's a difficult business. Mm-hmm. It's a really difficult business from the point of view of managing supply chain. And I'm doing it on my own with this. I have another smaller sportswear brand, Dough and Kerry, and I'm doing that on my own, and I'm getting good exposure to the machine that is supply chain and logistics and delivery and packaging and buying and selling. And it's tough. It's tough. And it would be hard to do it well on your own. Like, you look at someone like Kanye West, who has a huge business now with Adidas, but he had a label on his own that didn't survive, that didn't make the cut. You know, it failed, really. He has needed the likes of Nike and Adidas to help him do what he does. And I did think about that. I did consider that. But I've always admired Duns as a business in terms of its cultural significance in the country. And I felt that the storytelling aspect, the cultural storytelling aspect, would sit well with a business like Duns, where I then didn't have to worry about the supply chain aspect, all the logistical aspects. And of course, they have a huge retail footprint in the country as well.
Mm. I was interested. Your chat with Bork was very interesting in terms of how you both approached and how you both thought about it. And that really was a point I hadn't really considered, I suppose, because it's not something I've exposure to the fashion industry, but like the scale that's involved, the moving parts, the supply chain, the design, the sourcing, the shipping. It's a huge beast. So when you started then with Duns, how did it come about? Was there any kind of pushback, or did you go to them with a proposal, or how did it start?
I had actually been over and back to factories overseas, from the Middle East to the UK to Portugal. So I had had some experience of visiting factories, and I had had, you know, I'd been messing around with pieces of sportswear and shirting and cutting pieces up. And so I had actually put together a little range
Yeah.
Now let me tell you, it was a kind of an example of somebody who was trying. But it went a long way. I think the fact that I had gone and had shown the initiative to actually create 10 or 15 bits and pieces. Listen, it was very small. But so I was able to show that. I was able to present myself, explain what I wanted to do. I think a lot of it came down to the fact that I presented myself and I was able to face-to-face explain where I was coming from, how I saw the market in Ireland in terms of menswear and the Irish male mentality, and how I felt that this was needed. A brand like mine was needed to say the things that needed saying for a kind of a guy like me, a guy like my friends down at home. And I felt there was a good way. I felt there was I don't know if it's a better way or if it's a new way, but I felt there was a particular way that I had a particular point of view whereby I could drill into, through reading and research, drill into culture and through language, tell a story through clothes, if you get me.
Mm. The storytelling part is very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, well, agencies will come into head office from time to time, you know, obviously they're pitching for business or whatever and taking on a campaign. We look for agencies to take on campaigns by season. And the way I would present my brand with Dunn's would be, I see it as a like a curriculum, and there are like three main subjects in the curriculum. Culture is one. Masculinity, which is a tricky one now, and it's the one I don't. It's a tricky one to navigate, but it's a subject that has presented itself really in the course of, I think I have 11 seasons done now with Dunn's. It was only halfway through I saw a strong sense of masculinity come through in all the stories. And meaning is the third subject. So there has to be an element of culture. There tends to be an element of this type of masculinity that comes through, and there has to be meaning. And all these subjects are taught through a certain language. That language has to be adhered to through all the copywriting, the website copy, the press releases, any content we make. So the name and the name of the collection particularly are key. So that's how I see the brand, and that's how I present it. And that's what I think gives it its place in the Irish market and beyond. We do some sales overseas, but it's really quite an Irish brand.
Mm.
And those stories, I see them as books. Like the first one was Vanguard, second one was Push, Barn Mad, Mr. Shelby, Bogman, Raglan, Tattooed Man, Biker, Scaffolder. This current one, I'm missing one there, I think. Scaffolder is a tent. I might be missing one there, but I see them all as books, and I see the clothes as like words in a story, you know? And that's my approach.
It's an incredibly unique way of looking at it. I've never heard of a brand going that deep with a collection. I mean, it's an incredibly unique way. And how have people received that?
I guess pretty well. I think, yeah. I think the brand has done well. It does well. I think it's understood. For people who know the brand, I think they've come to kind of expect the bit of storytelling now, that the language part is important to me. I listen, my wife says to me, I get hung up on the, at the start I was really conceptual with Dunn's. I was like really tied into this narrative, this idea of having to tell a story a certain way, and it was quite it was a bit too conceptual. And then of course you look at what's going on around you and you realize this is a business and it's commerce. You start to balance the concept with the commerce. And my wife will say to me, I'll get really deep into it, because I do get deep into it and I'm very hands-on with it, but sometimes I get too deep into it. My wife will say, Paul, the guy just wants a shirt. You know what I mean? The guy just wants to come in. He just wants to come in and buy a t-shirt. And I say, no, Louise, there has to be a bollard print on this shirt, because Irish men don't realise this yet now, but so many of them work on building sites. I worked in building sites for 5 or 6 summers in a row. A lot of my friends would come up would be builders, carpenters, my brother's an electrician, plumbers, you know, that kind of...
It's a big part of the Irish, you know, guard, nurse, tradesman, teacher, you know,
tradesman. Core right there. I actually had a brand a number of years ago prepared, or it was a collection called Tradewear, going back a few years ago, where I figured, like, it's time to really speak to the tradesmen of the country. And that's what Scaffolder ultimately became. It was an idea for a brand years ago that became, some few years later, become Scaffolder. This current season that got kind of disrupted is called Scaffolder, and it speaks to the tradespeople of Ireland, tradesmen of Ireland that I know, the sites I worked on, and the gear is actually, some of the gear is really cool actually, and I think it could be better actually. I think tradesmen's clothing could be a lot better than what it is.
Yeah.
But obviously there are big brands out there like Dickies and Snickers and these doing that kind of business, and that's where tradespeople tend to go. But the pay, and they pay for it, you know. They're not cheap brands either.
They're wearing it every single day as well. They're getting up every single morning and they have to put on their tradesman gear. I think it's off the moment. I think there's young lads now, 21, 22, and they're super into their fashion now. And if they're a tradesman and they can balance that with fashion, I think you've struck on something. Probably 6-7 years ago, people would have been like, huh? Scaffolder?
Yeah. Jesus. And of course, what you see as well now, Gary, is on Facebook particularly, and I'm seeing a bit of it on TikTok, what you see is tradesmen very, very visible in Facebook content.
Yes.
Site content, be it choreographed dance, pranks, bloody accidents or close, kind of near misses to accidents.
Yeah.
But particularly pranking and dancing. You see your tradesman, and these are millions of views on Facebook videos. And so you know what I mean? I think it's a really interesting market. I do. I think it's going to get more interesting.
Yeah, definitely. That's so unique. As you say it there, like, yeah, just as you were saying, I was like, yeah, seen on Twitter, seen on Facebook, seen on Instagram, TikTok, you see all these
people. And it's business, you know, Gary. It's like these pages are set up because they know that the content is viral. It's viral content.
Yeah.
You know?
But everyone relates. Everyone has a mate or a brother or a sister who is a tradesman. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, listen, I'll tell you, some of the funniest days of my life were spent on building sites. I'm not messing. The characters you meet on building sites are some of the funniest. I spent the summer working with a guy down in Limerick, in Adair Manor, actually. I spent the summer on Adair Manor.
Oh, nice.
It's gone back maybe 15 or 16 years ago. There was work on the grounds of it. They were building, I'd say, what's now the coach houses at the coach house restaurant and all the apartments around, I think. That's what it was. But a man called Harry Nash, I'll never forget him. He was a Glaswegian. And he had, shall we say, he had a kind of a checkered past and would have been no stranger now to a life of crime and maybe, you know, incarceration even. And he had a lot of stories about his time in jail. And these are the experiences. And you're working side by side with this man. And you think, you know, anything could happen at any moment, any day. But it's really exciting. And the stories are brilliant.
And how did you start then with Dunn? So you came to him with the pitch. I think that's very interesting. You did your 15 things there. I think that's very interesting. I think anyone, I've talked to what, 50 entrepreneurs now, and they all start with this rough little idea and they do something. They start something. It mightn't be the finished product, but they just do something to get going.
Yeah.
It's the people who stick with the idea and go, oh, I have an idea. I just don't know what to do. It's the people that just make something. Just a physical representation of what they want to do and just go out and try because it'll never take off. So you went to them with 15 things. They're like, that sounds good, Paul.
I went and took the Arab. I was spending a lot of time in the Middle East, not a lot of time in the Middle East, but I had a lot of friends in the Middle East and teaching and builders, developers. And I was going visiting them quite a bit. I really like the pace of life in the Middle East. I say to people, you'll never see an Arab person in a hurry. They just float along really slow. I like the pace of life there. When I'm rushing around here the whole time, I go to Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and it's just a really slow pace of life. But I looked at the quality of the cottons that the men were wearing, these traditional dish dashes, full length dish dashes. I think they're called dish dashes. Anyway, I brought a whole load of those back. I chopped them. I thought they'd make great shirts because they had this really nice brown collar. And they have a half placket covered buttons, and they just make a good shape. If you were to cut them halfway down, just below your waist, make a good shape for a shirt. So that's what I did. They became the centerpiece of this collection I presented to Dunn's. It was called the Black and White Collection. I had some white modified dish dashes, some black ones. Then I had chopped up some shirts and stuck a few bits onto a shirt. And I had messed around with a pair of shoes, a pair of trainers that I had chopped up and added a layer to the sole to add a midsole. And I had, what else had I done? I had a few pieces of denim that I had messed around with. And then I had some print ideas that I was talking about more so that I couldn't really present what I told them about, and that was it. It was the collection was the collection became Vanguard, which was my first collection, and it was really based upon that first presentation, or I call it an effort, an attempt.
How did you figure that out? How did you learn how to just start basic editing and basic design? Where did you get that from?
Oh, I don't. In terms of that stuff, I just bought some dish dashes and cut the ends off them. That was as simple as that. I took a scissors to a shirt and cut the collar off a shirt. Really just cutting bits up, really. That's all it was. I subsequently have learned the Adobe Illustrator suite in terms of graphic design. Do a little bit of graphic design, but I'm not really taught. I'm not formally trained at all in the terms of the design aspect. I'm really self-taught from the point of view. I'm really interested, have been really interested for 20 years. And I've learned through interest what I know. I've learned through interest. And then I have just my own point of view, my own ideas. And I follow them for life, really. I follow my own ideas for as a way of life.
It's best about learning, isn't it?
Yeah.
So then you just were self-taught. You went to Dunn's, you did the first collection, you worked with them, said, this is what I want to do, sketched out.
Yeah, I did feel that, like, probably from the language point of view, I'm really a writing, and like, I wrote for the Sunday Times for a number of years. I wrote my own book. I'm a teacher. My background is in teaching. So I have a degree in arts. I have a higher diploma in education. I taught Irish and geography. I'm really sorry I didn't teach English. But really, writing and publishing is where my interests lie. So I figured I could make a real difference in terms of the marketing point of view, and the copywriting point of view, and the content point of view. I felt I could add a lot of value to the market in those areas, aside from creating the collection side, naming it, telling the story through research and culture, and finding out about whatever. I researched, like, the national anthem. And I based the first collection upon the national anthem. Aside from that, the writing aspect is where I probably added a bit of value as well. And I think all those things combined showed Dunn's that this was somebody who had some skill sets and a kind of a point of view that they could work with, you know.
And when did you transition out of teaching?
Oh, 2010, I think.
Okay, and was that around the same time? Was that a conscious decision? You're like, yeah, give this a go.
Yeah. I was working away on creating a brand for a while, and I eventually just made the leap. It was a leap of faith because it was a hard thing to do, but I just figured my future wasn't in teaching, and I knew that just my instincts and my intuition was telling me to follow this path in terms of trying to tell. And I still see what I do with Dunn's as a form of education, in a way, in that lots of people come back to me and say, well, I didn't know that. If I get into the details of the various stories, there's lots of learning, and there has to be, for me, to make it kind of interesting for me, there has to be a learning aspect to each season, each story. And there always has been. So I still see this as a form of education in a funny way. And funnily enough, since I've begun with Dunn's, I've learned way more about life and history and architecture and culture and art and sport and war. I've actually learned way more myself these last number of years than I ever did teaching. So I just figured if I continued teaching, I wouldn't be a good one. I just wasn't going to be a great teacher because my interest levels were waning.
Right.
My performance as a teacher was going the same way.
Okay. That's a question I get a lot, is people message in after hearing a guest or whatever, and they're like, but how did they know? How did they, like, loads, everyone's got a business idea. Everyone's got something in them. They've got that idea that just want to let go and get out there. How did you know? I think you've kind of answered that already, but you just knew inherently. You seem like a very intuitive person. You're very tapped into yourself. You just knew.
Well, I think interests, like, you know, you've got to follow your interests. I think if you have an interest in life, you have to pursue it. And these are the things you think about. You should do what you think about mostly. Do you know what I mean? If there's something you think about every day, that's probably something in and around that is what you should be doing.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this all the time, and I said, you've got to pursue this if you're going to enjoy it and if you're really interested. I'm a big believer in interest in life. I talk to footballers all the time. I only look for interested footballers, because an interested footballer will only improve. and will never stop improving. As long as you're interested, you'll never stop getting better at a thing. So for me, it was about pursuing this interest I had, and that's where it came from. And I knew I had a point of view that I could add, that would add a bit of something to the market that wasn't already there, you know.
I think that's a really good point. I think it's very, people just are like, oh, but I couldn't give up the job. You know, this is the job. You know, it's, they never really listen to that
easy.
Voice.
It's not
voice.
Easy. It took me a year, like it took me more about 18 months to actually finally go and do it.
Hmm.
I'll never forget it, going in to tell the principal I wasn't coming back. This was June. At all. And I had another year. If I had done another year teaching, I would have been on a permanent contract. That would be me for life.
Right.
Had I done one more year.
Yeah, there is a tipping point. There's always a tipping point in life.
Well, that was a tipping point for me. Had I come back in September and continued on with my next year of teaching, I'd have been a teacher for the rest of my days. And I had to do it. And it was a hard thing to do. It's very hard. It's an easy thing to talk about now, but it was a very hard thing to do. It's not an easy thing for anyone to do, to take a leap, that leap, but I had to do it. I decided to do it. Ultimately, I decided to definitely do it 6 months earlier when I was in Jamaica. I was on a team holiday. I was on a holiday with some friends, and there was a cliff jump in a place called Rick's Cafe in Jamaica. It's in a place called Negril. And these local guys will do these just outrageous cliff dives. So the cliff is like 30 meters. Then there's this gum tree that grows from the cliff upwards. You never see anything like it. It's a tree with no vegetation, no leaf, barely. You wonder how anybody could stand on it. It looks so kind of dried out and almost malnourished. But these locals were climbing it. They were like Rastafari guys with dreads. They were going another 30 meters diving into the sea.
Wow.
And I saw this cliff dive and I figured, whatever it was in me, I'm not a great swimmer, but I really wanted to do the dive. And I couldn't do it that day because I had no sharks, and I went back home and I didn't actually sleep properly that night.
Really?
About this cliff dive. Well, I hadn't thought about this. I couldn't stop thinking about this cliff, jumping off this cliff. So the next morning I got up, I went back to the same place. I told one of my buddies I was going, and he came with me, and I dived off this cliff like 35 meters into the sea, and I came back out of the ocean, and that was it. I remember that. I remember the aftermath of doing the rush of it. I was like, yeah, I'm leaving teaching and I'm going to just take risks. I'm just going to take risks for the rest of my life if I can.
That's unbelievably symbolic, like that fear.
It was later that year that I left teaching that summer. That was in January, and I left teaching that following June.
Was it like a mental breakthrough? Was it just you faced that challenge of just, right, this is like symbolic. If I break this, I break through?
Yeah, I don't really know what it was. It was just something inside me, you know. And I think it's just the buzz of it—the buzz of a cliff jump for a start, like, and feeling that feeling of kind of, I'm probably not the strong. I'm a strong enough swimmer, but I probably wouldn't be a strong enough swimmer now to be jumping into the sea. But it was the risk. It was the risk element, and that's where my business name came from. Actually, Go There, Go There. My business is called Go There, GODARE.
Yeah,
and it felt like a dare to me. You know, okay. No, I didn't tell. I told my buddy, I said, I'm jumping off that cliff. I don't care before I go home. And I actually, that's where my business name came from as well. It was just the fact that I went back there and I dared myself to do it. So that's why I called my business Go There Creative.
Brilliant.
And
And how, okay, so you've left the decision. It's June. What happens then?
I actually started my first website. I had my first kind of, I started a kind of a fashion website. It was like, this is paulgalvin.com, where I spoke a lot about music, fashion, and the brands and kind of sports brands, sportswear brands, you know, the Adidas's and the Nikes, and New Balance is a brand I love. My first pair of trainers were New Balance. New Balance had a factory in Tralee.
Really?
I was very young. New Balance made shoes in Tralee. And my aunt, my cousin, worked in the factory, and she was my godmother. She came home one day with a pair of New Balance trainers that I absolutely loved. So fresh from the factory. So, like, yeah. So I started talking about sportswear brands, music, culture. Did that for a few years. Should have kept going with it, but I got tired of it.
It's hard going.
Google started to squeeze the thing a little bit, and I stopped, and I kind of, yeah. So I did that for a few years, and I wrote in the Irish Independent magazine for a few years, and then I started up. I did my book, and then I went to Dunn's.
Right.
Okay, so you kept busy. Where does that come from, Paul, that motivation? Because that's another one people are like, oh, I just don't know how I'd sustain myself if I didn't have a boss.
I don't know how I'd sustain myself if I did have a boss.
that's my answer. I'm just uncoachable or untrainable at this stage.
My wife is my boss, and that's enough. That's enough for me. But no, I just wanted to be my own boss as well.
Same.
Big time. Yeah.
I could never go back. I think once you taste it, once you get that kind of that
feeling. Yeah. I'm actually getting to the stage now where I wouldn't mind being part of a team somewhere again. You know.
On your terms, though, I'm going to guess. On your
pardon?
Not full time, not like 9 to 5, Paul. Here's your tie. I think it'd be on your terms, like what you're doing now, an agency where you kind of do contract work, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. I would like to. The copywriting side is really interesting. The copywriting and the content side is really interesting. And I'm really interested in advertising. So yeah, like it would be really interesting to work as part of a team within an agency. All right. Yeah. That's something I'm thinking about a little bit, but it's not easy. Obviously, look, you know, big agencies have hire people on a particular basis and they don't normally that kind of a structure where you bring in like somebody part-time or on a consultancy basis. Mm. It's not a model really that you see a whole lot of.
I think it's going to become the model. I think it's going to be like, I read a great article, I can't remember where it was, but they were talking about business in the future, business post-COVID, and they were saying it'll be like movie sets. So it'll be like shooting a movie. You'll put a great team together. You'll be like, okay, I'm going to get Paul for copyright and design. I'm going to get John because he's super on production. I'm going to get fucking Gary for doing the audio. Put them together. All right, lads, we're going to do this for the next 3 months. This is our project. This is our deliverable. 3 months, done. And then after that, you disband. I might work with you for another 3 months on something else. I think that's the future for a lot of companies. I think they won't want that 700 people sitting in an office. They'll want highly specific individuals, highly trained, to come together for a project and then disband.
Yeah, no, I think you're dead right. And I think it's something that I'm really interested in kind of observing and you know, that way of working, I think is a new department. It's new here in Ireland, probably. Mm. You see a little bit of that happening in the States, to be fair. Like the sportswear brands the big sportswear brands have now become very, very collaborative, and they've taken the hands off quite a bit in that they're experimenting a great deal.
Mm.
And their way of working now has become much more, there are more moving parts, there's more collaboration, there's more risks been taken. So I think that will become more prevalent. Like you say, I think you're dead right.
Mm, I think so. Well, you see like Under Armour and The Rock and people like that, they do these specific collections and then they're able to build up hype. Whereas, you know, Under Armour as a brand, it's very hard to differentiate yourself in the market. If it's just, oh, here's the winter collection. Okay, that's fine. But when it's The Rock or it's Paul Galvin or whoever it is, Jordan Spieth, whoever it is, it's a specific, here's our big launch. This is the Spieth range. There it is.
Yeah, yeah. And if they're struggling probably to find new categories as well in terms of product, Under Armour, they're really tied into the compression wear. Mm. Footwear is big for them, but the compression wear and that really true gym athletic stuff.
Mm.
Is really big for them, and I think they probably need to diversify a little bit. They're a company that could really do that new way of working.
Yeah.
In terms of collaborating a little bit more and bringing in probably, you know, having new conversations with new markets.
Mm, look at Gymshark, their growth in the last, I know what, 9 years, I think it is, or even less maybe. That's mind-blowing.
Yeah. And Boohoo's another one. Boohoo have a huge cash pile at the moment, and they're looking now at any of the smaller, and not even small, medium-sized brands that are struggling in the post-COVID, looking to acquire lots of those ones that maybe are struggling in terms of cash flow. And yeah, so I think the market, I think, yeah, how brands operate and the market in general would become very, I think there'll be more opportunities, become a bit more fluid and a bit more collaborative, I think. Even though collaboration happens, there's still an element. It's still hard. It's hard to collaborate. Collaboration is a skill I've learned.
Oh, yeah.
It really is a skill. And you've got to be really, you've got to have a certain mindset, because otherwise it's a hard one to pull off.
Communication is so hard. Communicating exactly what you want and been open and been able to take on feedback and been able to, it is an art. It's definitely a skill, and very few people have that communication skill, I think.
Yeah, it is a communication skill, yeah. And that's another thing I've been asking myself throughout this last few weeks in terms of weeks and months, in terms of my own communication skills. How am I? How am I doing in terms of my communication? I'm a good written communicator. I can be very clear and constructive in my written communication. I can be a little bit better in my face-to-face communication, I've learned. But yeah, collaboration equals communication, I think, is the lesson for you. You're trying to
going to make a note of that. 39 minutes 44. Yeah. But as a manager, that must be, you know, a huge part of your job. That must be something you're working on all the time.
It's a big thing. You have to find, and there are levels of it. Then, you know, you have to find a certain level with this guy, a certain level with that guy, a certain level with this guy. So it really kind of, you're thinking that you're a good communicator. Thinking that you're a good communicator isn't enough, because good communication to you with him, that might be good communication for him, but it might be bad for him.
Yeah.
Do you understand? Like he might get it, he might not. So you have to find, you've got to actually spend time with a guy and find his level, find the level of communication that works within the group dynamic, you know?
I was listening to an interview with Andy Robertson, the Liverpool player, and he was talking, they're asking him, you know, what makes Klopp so unique? And he said exactly what you just said. He was like, he will go into a room with 30 players and have 30 different conversations. He'll be up with one guy. He'll be gentle with one guy. He'll be hard on another guy. He'll be talking to another guy about something he's interested in. He'll be encouraging one guy. He'll be, you know, telling another guy how he needs to improve. He'll be telling another guy, right, your standards are dropping. You know, he said he's 30 individual conversations, and he says that's what makes him such a unique talent.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, it is, and that's what probably makes the management in GAA in any sport. That's where the time goes. That's what really makes it time consuming. When people talk about managers getting burned out, managers getting tired, and managers getting a whole that kind of unseen time, that kind of stuff behind the scenes, where you have 35 or 40 guys, and you want to do right by each one of them, and really doing right by each one of them is finding the level that you can connect and communicate with that person at. And it takes a good bit of energy.
I think if people that watch any kind of sport, they just see the match and they see, well, Paul just takes the lads for training for an hour, four times a week. You know, what's the big deal? But it's all that background time. How do you find that time? Or how do you make that time?
You just have to make it. Phone calls. As best you can. Look, and some guys, you know what, some guys don't. And the other thing is, some guys don't want the communication. I think some guys absolutely are fine and they don't need it or want a whole lot of communication. You've got to let those guys be as well. You know, you can overdo it easily, like, and you feel you have to be in a fella's ear the whole time. And, like, I don't believe in that way. I'm not. I communicate on a kind of, if I sense a need to. You know, it's a kind of a case-by-case basis, I find. And if I feel I don't need to, I won't. Because guys, you know, this day and age, guys get the message and they get sick of the message just as easily. The message is fresh for a while. The message will stay fresh for a while, but then the message will go stale quite easily. Especially if you're banging on, kind of in the fella's ear unnecessarily.
Okay. Is there an overload of information these days, do you think?
I think there can be. I think there can be, definitely. And look, it's all about the level you're at too. And I mean, it depends on resources, what you can afford to bring to a setup and what you can't. And I think there could be definitely a case of maybe too much information at times.
Was managing something you always wanted to get into when you stopped playing?
Not really, no. It was more so, it was a bit like getting into the business of the clothing business. Same thing. It wouldn't leave me alone. It was in my head. Had looked at the market, like, it was a bit like looking at the football market, looking at how the game had been played. I spent 4 years really studying the game. But after I retired, writing for the Times, watching lots of games, studying what was happening and developing your own ideas. And it was really that. The opportunity came along and I felt no more than I could add to the menswear market with Dunn's in terms of saying something or doing something a certain way. I felt maybe I had the same instinct or intuition on the football side.
Interesting.
So we'll see. It's getting that stuff out and see how it lands and see how well you can improve, guys. And it's really interesting for me from that point of view.
How do you set up your week? As in, how do you approach planning? Because that's another one for entrepreneurs. They kind of, I'm 100% guilty of it, the shiny object syndrome. How do you avoid kind of hopping from, I'd imagine you have a huge amount of commitments in a normal week. So how would you sit down and plan, say, like your normal week or normal month?
Yeah, I've probably gone away from my habits a little bit in the last few months, but really I run a lot in the mornings. I found that when I run, I get good ideas. So I run with a pen. I nearly always have a pen with me when I'm running. Sometimes I have a magazine with me as I run. Sometimes I'm a huge believer in magazines. I'm a student of magazines, and kind of the contents page on a magazine is just, I find, underrated, kind of underappreciated, I think, if it's a good magazine. But I run with a pen. I find I get some, you can unlock things when you're running, and I'll start with that.
Just pen a little notebook, is it?
Pen a little, usually a napkin. When the cafes were open, I would go to the restaurant.
This is brilliant.
Take a lot of notes on a napkin. Or if it came to me as I was running, it'd go straight on my hand. And then to a cafe, onto a napkin. And I have a, it's empty now, but before COVID, I had a jug up there that was just full of napkins of my notes from the run.
If I walk, I
get a different thought process than as I walk. If I walk, I tend to get more decisions. If I run, I tend to get more ideas. Excuse me. So that it usually starts with that kind of thing. Plan my day. Unlock the things I need to unlock. If I need to crack a name for a collection, or I need to crack something about a print idea or a piece of content or a conversation or a piece of communication that's required. Usually start my day with a run, come back, change. It depends on what comes up on email then, kind of thing, or where I might have to go. Sometimes I like company, more times I don't like company. So if I feel I need to be around people, I go and visit some people that I like to be around. And if I don't, I spend the day maybe at the desktop reading, researching, emailing, dealing with inquiries, dealing with factories, dealing with whatever comes up.
Okay, so you work from home?
Well, previous to this, I would have been into Dunn's head office.
All right, okay.
At least a couple of times a week, two or three times a week. So I have a little office in Dunn's head office. So I would have spent a good bit of time in there. It feels like a completely different world now, and a completely different time. So depending on meetings and the requirements, I would go into Dunn's if I needed a bit of... There'll be a lot of samples in from factories that you need to go and spend time with.
Okay.
I find I need to spend time with clothes and collections, sitting with them. They'll be hanging on a railing and just sitting with them. And color is a big thing, like color combinations. And you have to kind of absorb color, I find. I have to absorb color to make sure combinations work. And then there's fits that need to be taken care of. So I would have fitted every sample that comes in. I would fit myself. And there'll be changes made then, depending on whether the sample was out of tolerance or intolerance regarding or spec for my brand and that kind of thing. So that's a big thing, because if fit is wrong, then the shape will be wrong. It'll photograph poorly. Proportions will be off. Yeah, silhouettes will be off. So that's something I would do a lot of, depending on when samples arrive, straight into the office to fit them on and speak to fit technicians, speak to the buying team. Check fabrics. I like certain fabrics with a bit of structure and a bit of shape, again, because they make certain shapes and they hold their shape well, and that photographs well, which I find drives sales. And prior to the lockdown, being to Dunn's whenever I was needed, usually a couple of times a week. Then I work with other people then, like collaborate with other people that I would go and visit, be it a barber, an artist, people I like to be around, spend time with them, kick around ideas. Excuse me.
So maybe like your external creative team, you go just thrash out ideas with people.
Yeah. I have a whole host of those people that help me with graphic. They'd help me anyway. They'd help me with graphic design. They'd help me with content. They'd help me with sourcing. I'm interested in what they do. They're interested in what I do.
Yeah.
So they're everything from artists to graphic designers to barbers to other, we'll say, creative types, you know.
I was texting my barber this morning to see any update on the opening. I could badly need a trim.
You and me both. I tackled my own hair there a couple of days ago.
Did you?
I used to do it myself for years. I spent years cutting my own hair.
Did you?
Going back a few years. And then I'm good friends with Sam Donnelly and James Donnelly, Sam's barbers. They've been my barbers for the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, Aaron down a faction just underneath me there in Temple Bar in the office. And great lads, but yeah, definitely can do with them. Those lads reopening. I think you need that circle. I'm actually going to see one of the lads after this. You need those people just to get out of your head. For me, it's to get out of my head, because I'll sit here. This is my home office. I'll sit here and I'll just be like working on something. And you just get in the same loop, just this pattern loop of just overthinking it. And you might go down the rabbit hole for 2 hours. Where often you just go out and chat it out with someone and go, what are you working on? And don't even think about your own problem. Just chat about whatever they're working on.
Big time. And see if you can help them.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, you need that.
That's important. I love studying young people and young talent and seeing, and often they get in touch, young people get in touch, a lot of young musicians will get in touch. Ryan Hennessy's another guy I hang out with a lot.
Okay.
Quite a lot. Ryan Hennessy, if you picture this, he's a great guy, really talented guy, has an unbelievable, he's a genius ability to write music, write songs, create a hit. He's, Jimmy Rainsford is the drummer in Picture This. They were the two boys that founded Picture This. I spend a bit of time with them. I find them brilliant to be around. Jimmy's brilliant. Jimmy and Ryan used to make my videos, my early videos for Guns, the Born Mad one, the Shelby one. They made 3 or 4 of my launch videos for Duns. Being around those people is important. And then young talent like that coming through, if you can shine a light on them and help them forward, I think that's important as well.
It keeps you tapped in, keeps you relevant, to stop getting stuck in your own industry. I mean, it's very easy to get stuck in your own, whatever that is, that own kind of niche, because you have to be obsessed. Like, clearly you are obsessed with what you do, the designs that you go so deep on it, and you have to be. But then also you need those other things coming in that are just totally out of your range.
Yeah, and I need to be feeding my mind as well. Like, I've learned from my next collection with Duns, it's called, I was throwing around a few names, but I was going to call it Gaelic Artistic Association. I think, I'm not sure that'll work with the GAA.
Yeah, you might be getting this listener's letter.
But I've been looking at a lot of Jack Yeats paintings, you know, and like art has got into my head now, and I'm consuming and kind of reading and researching and observing lots of art and artists. And but Jack Yeats, I've learned, Jack Yeats was Ireland's first Olympic medalist.
Really?
He won a silver medal in the 1924 Paris Games for in the art and culture was category, an Olympic sport. And he won a silver medal for a painting called Liffey Swim. The Liffey Swim still happens, actually.
That's unreal.
Up until recently, there was a Liffey Swim. They probably passed you by on the
Yeah,
bar.
They did. They finished up down below, yeah.
Yeah. That was the first Olympic medal Ireland ever won by Jack Yeats.
That's unbelievable.
Liffey Swim, but he also has a painting called The Funeral of Harry Boland, which is a picture, a painting of Harry Boland's burial, graveside burial. And Harry Boland was obviously a military figure alongside Michael Collins during the Rising. But he was a big GAA figure. He hurled for Dublin.
Right.
He was Dublin County Board Chairman, and he refereed actually the 1918 All-Ireland football final between Kerry and Wexford. So I like that kind of synergy between art and sport, and that's what keeps me interested and motivated and kind of keeps me.
How do you dive into that? Because obviously you go deep when you go deep into something. How do you? Is it just something catches your eye as you're out for a run and you're like a napkin? I want to look up Yeats or whoever it is.
No, Harry. Military has been a big thing. Military influence has been a big thing in the stories. If I go back to the start, the vanguard. The word vanguard was just in my head a lot. I couldn't get it out. I thought it was a great word. I have a bit of an obsession for words. I'm on my dictionary every day. It's one thing I think with copywriters across businesses, be you in a retailer, be you in a property company, be you in a bloody hotel industry, hospitality, car trade, whatever it might be. I think every copywriter should have a dictionary. I don't know how many copywriters sit with a dictionary, but anyway, I'm on my dictionary a lot, and words, if a word gets into my head, it won't go out. So vanguard was in my head. It comes from the word avant-garde, which is a kind of a philosophical movement, But vanguard has a military connotation as well. You know, vanguard soldiers were the lead unit in a military formation in World War One that would go out ahead to secure safe passage for the rest of the army, you know. And I just like that element of risk-taking. But anyway, military has been quite an influence. If I look at this 4 or 5 collections I've done or stories I've told that have had a military background. And Harry Boland, it was really Harry Boland himself and his military background mixed with his political background, mixed with his sporting background. And then I came upon that painting by Jack B. Yeats, and I began to discover more about Jack B. Yeats through Harry Boland, actually. So it's interest. It's pursuing interest, really. Mm.
You just pull a thread. You find one thread and you just keep connecting it back along.
That's exactly it. And that's how my business... That's exactly a great way to describe what I do with Duns. I discover something and the discovery keeps running and running.
How long does it take you to put that all together? Because it seems like a very consuming process. It seems like something... And you seem like someone who just... Like the words won't get out of your head. It seems like it just consumes you.
Yeah, I'm always on it, really. I find it very hard to switch off from the things I'm into. And be it... The football management has been great from that point of view because it gives me another thing to focus on, because for the last while it's been really focused on establishing the Duns business and trying to grow it and trying to make it as just trying to establish it in a strong manner in the market, and I get consumed by that kind of thing. Then you just day to day you're thinking of this, because like you said earlier, there's so many moving parts, and you're trying to create content, implement ads on Facebook, which I was doing for quite a while, and I really enjoyed creating the content, implementing the ad, targeting. And I found through Facebook, I found again the key being language. Like, language is key to my business, but it's also key, really, really key to Facebook marketing in terms of your copy and your creative. Your targeting is important, but if your copy is not good, I don't think it negates the quality, you know what I mean, your ability to target people. But
I think copywriting is one of those things that's vastly, vastly, vastly underrated. People don't.
I couldn't agree more.
People don't think about it because they see something and it moves them. Or it forces a reaction, or it gets you to buy, or whatever it is, but they don't think why. Well, what's the reason? And it's the words strung together that just create that thing. Your finger clicks on the mouse. That's your action. You've touched an emotion or a feeling. It's something I've started studying during COVID as well. Is just copywriting, going back to learn what is good writing, because it's something we all take for granted now. It's something you just do every day. And a lot of people, I think, have just do really poorly because they've just got into a really habit of just WhatsApp, just really as short and as brief as you can. And sometimes consciously made an effort just write every day, just to, it's the way I think. I think by writing, I get things down on paper, because otherwise it just kind of spins around, just kind of goes in a loop.
Yeah, I haven't been able to. I've been trying, but it's just, I'm coming out of it a little bit, but in the middle of this lockdown, I wasn't able to string a sentence together. But like, you know, this whole sustainability conversation, Gary, that we hear about, and it's very valid, and we in Duns are practicing it and looking to get better at it. And obviously it relates to materials and fabrics and packaging. All these things are, but there, I feel like, they're almost the end product in terms of the sustainable conversation. I think the true sustainability, or not true sustainability, but an overlooked element is meaning and the words and language and copy that you use, like, and the position of your brand in the market. If there has to be, for me, meaning is the only thing that really will, not the only thing, but meaning will sustain as well. Mm. Meaning has a really strong, if you have a meaningful basis for a brand where you're saying something, uncovering something, discovering something, teaching something, remembering something, I think that's sustainable. I think that's a form of sustainability. And even if the garment will never die, even if there's poly cotton, even if there's a polyelastin, even if it has a long lifespan, if it's saying something important, are saying something that remembers somebody who's been forgotten, or an incident, or a book, or a piece of art, or an event that's been forgotten, and we're remembering it. And I'm happy for that garment to live forever. I want that garment to live forever. And I think that's something brands could look at. What are we trying to say for a start before we look at our fabrications, our supply chain, our packaging, our parceling, our waste, our resources? Are we saying something that means something, that needs to be said, that needs to be remembered? I think that's a form of sustainability too.
That's a beautiful way to look at things. I think even the story you told me about the Olympic medal, that's going to stay with me. That's just in my head now. That's all I'm thinking about is as we're talking. I'm just, that's going round and round in my head. Yeah, I think that's...
There and all, there's lessons like that. And the one thing I really enjoy about this business with Don's Trugot there is that there's loads of that. In every season, there's discovery and education.
It's
and
rare like though. It's very rare.
Thread, yeah.
It's very rare. I think a lot of brands have lost touch of that. They've lost touch of how they started. Maybe they started with a founder like yourself, and they've just exploded to, you know, global operation with 10,000-20,000 employees, and they've lost that meaning of what they're actually trying to do.
Yeah, and you know, I consider myself very, very lucky to be able to do this as I do with Dunn's. They allow me to do it this way, you know. I'm in a very fortunate position that I have their supply chain, their supply base. Their retail footprint, their teams in-house, all the expertise that they have to allow me to actually say the things that I want to say and write these stories, I think is a privilege, you know. And I've seen over the last couple of months, again, I've seen the kind of group, the resilience of Dunn's from the point of view of how it provides for people and how it kind of, Dunn's have really, what would I say, embraced this lockdown period. Of course, they were so busy on the grocery side, I'm sure, but they've also showed a compassion and a kind of a strength that not too many businesses can do, you know?
No, well, that crisis brings out the best of the worst. It brings out what a company is truly about. I think it brings out the real side of a company. It magnifies what you are.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I've seen it at close quarters over the years, and especially in these last few months with True Dunn's, you know. And I think there's an opportunity actually for these big retailers to look at media. You know, if you look at the media landscape at the moment and where we go for news and how fragmented our news sources become and how hard it is to believe what we're hearing anymore, it's hard to know what's true and what's not. And I think the retailers, especially grocery retailers, have now kind of moved to a place in this people's psyche of becoming a real source of trust and truth, and kind of, be you a barista or a baker or a butcher or a grocer, people have kind of looked to you and for you and have depended upon you these last few weeks and months, and you kind of feel like you're going to the grocer for your news almost, and that source of trust and dependability, you know. And I think it's an interesting time for grocers in terms of what they might start to do in terms of newsletters, information, education, news, you know, as becoming a source of more than just grocery and maybe other things, I don't know.
That's a really interesting perspective. Yeah, I like that, because during COVID, the one place I was going every week was the grocery. That's the one place you would go every single week. That was the, and you thought about it. You thought about what you were picking up because it mattered more. Whereas before, you know, you're picking things up, or you just nip out and get something else. It was very much transactional.
You were learning about COVID, and you were getting updated, and you were learning about the latest developments in terms of the virus through your grocer almost.
Yeah.
It was there you were going. What were the opening hours? And what's the latest situation? So you were almost going to the grocers before you were going to the kind of maybe the media outlets, you know?
That's a very interesting point, actually. I must think on that because, yeah, media, it's just the last 2 weeks, I've just really just shut down a lot of consuming social media because I just can't deal with
it. You don't know night from day. Don't know true from not true. Exactly. You don't know who to trust. There's so much spin and conspiracy and... it's just so reductive that it's hard to believe in it.
Yeah, even yesterday I was looking at a new product launched, something simple as a new email provider called Hey, and just unbelievable hype. And I was looking through and I was like, oh, is this good? And then one guy was like, oh, this is the best email ever. And the other guy's like, this is the worst email ever. And you're like, geez, that kind of summed it up for me. And I just clicked X. That kind of summed it up. Something as simple as an email provider people were getting all hot and bothered about. As you said, there's a real opportunity, I think, for trust and building that platform of trust.
I think so, because you also have a big, probably you'll have a media organization will have their audience, but the grocers and the retailers have their audience as well. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think
curation is going to be, yeah, we're talking earlier about ideas that are going to come out of COVID. I think curation of things, services, but also information people who will validate it and go, yes, this is true because X. And then they will be your person. You'll go to, I'll go to Paul for my approved, you know, scientific reports. I'll go to Gary for approved sport. You know, you'll just, that'll be your, yeah, your focus of truth. And it'll be people, I think. I think individuals with profiles will become more important. I think they'll also kind of like, they'll probably partner up. The Currency is a new Irish online business platform. They're doing very, very well because they're kind of becoming that platform of trust to reporters from the, yeah, Sunday Business Post set it up. And it's really interesting so far. We're almost done. I have two last questions for you. The last one you can think about, you might have a lot of recommendations, is every week we give away a book that's had an impact on that person over the course of their life. It can be a story or it can be, you know, anything really. So have a little think about what, you know, what book you would like to give away. So we'll just, they literally have to tag, so you can decide who you want to tag, if it's Duns and yourself or whoever it is. Just something that's had an impact on you. I'm sure you've had a lot.
Sure.
And then what's making you excited now? As you're looking to the future, you've had a lot of time to reflect. What's exciting you?
Good question. I mean, I don't know what's exciting me. I think what I'm hoping for creative people and for kind of, I think the democracy, like you take something like Netflix. I've learned a lot. You know, you talk about homeschooling, and I've heard a lot about homeschooling through COVID. I've actually learned a lot myself throughout the period from Netflix. I have found Netflix has homeschooled me, and I actually based the collection Shelby a couple of seasons back was based on Tommy Shelby from Peaky Blinders.
I was going to ask you, what a show.
Thomas Shelby. What a show. Whole Thomas Shelby thing, but the original idea was actually Netflix. It was Netflix inspired, because I loved, this is going back 3 years or so, I loved the democracy of Netflix and how it had democratized the market in terms of content creators and people who now had an opportunity to make a film or a documentary or a series and have it placed and get paid and the whole shebang. Mm. So I'm finding now I've learned so much over the last couple of weeks about politics and art and architecture, sport, technology, bioarchitecture from Netflix. And I'm excited about what the new market will look like in terms of, first of all, from a commercial point of view, in terms of sales, but also what the opportunities will be.
Mm.
I think there might be an opening up of mindsets and a new way of looking at the art of collaboration and the art of idea sharing. I think that's probably something I'm watching not closely, but I'm interested to observe more, you know.
I agree. I think it's going to be this explosion. Well, I'm probably hopeful more so that there's going to be this explosion of talent. People who've probably went down the path maybe of, you know, going to the careers, kind of going, all right, this is what I'm doing. And now suddenly they've just got those 2 or 3 months to go, no, I'm super passionate about art. I'm super passionate about design. I'm super passionate about writing. I'm going to do that book. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. But like, it's unbelievable. You can literally reach out. Look at me and you, Chan. You know what I mean? I didn't know you a couple of months ago. And, you know, through the magic of the internet, suddenly we're connected and suddenly we're chatting here. And who knows where that goes next in terms of who hears this conversation and reaches out to you. And then you start working. You know, it's magic. If you're putting the right energy out there, I think, you know, the internet is more good than that.
I think architecture is the other big one I'm interested in. I think bioarchitecture and urban planning and architecture, I think, is something I'm really interested in at the moment. I think it'd be really interesting to see what happens with regard to stadiums, sports stadiums, and stadium design. I'm reading a lot at the moment about stadium design, and it's unbelievable what these architecture firms are doing with regard to stadium design and sound design, which I'm really interested in. And I think how sports bodies react to the new kind of world we live in terms of their stadium design going forward will be interesting. That's one thing. And I think the creators and the grocers, I think, will become the new sources of trust and truth. They're like truth tellers or truth seekers, you know, that kind of way. That's really there where my thoughts are, like, in terms of what the new market will look like. I think there's an opportunity for people like grocers to maybe become more like publishers of news and media. Mm. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with urban planning and architecture, particularly sports architecture.
Well, who knows what happens with cities now? Before, it was this suck inwards. of, you know, every day at, you know, between 7 and 9, there was this inward suck of maybe 200,000 or 300,000 people into the city centre, into this tiny little hub. And now it's the exact opposite, whereby everyone is now dispersed outwards and probably will remain that way.
Yeah, I think the urban landscape will change quite a bit. And that's interesting. That will be interesting. I think you'll see probably a lot of innovation in around urban planning. I'm hoping you see lots of innovation around urban planning and the use of urban spaces.
Yeah.
I think there's an opportunity now to do that. And other than that, yeah, I just keep pursuing the words and the ideas and telling the stories that I think need telling with the help of Duns and
pulling that thread. When's your next collection out, by the way?
We're probably pushing our launch collection. We're probably pushing autumn. Should have been coming out around the next couple of weeks. That's been pushed back now to, I think, maybe October.
Right.
And next spring we'll launch probably late January. So the autumn season will probably launch October. Is called, I think it'll be called Boland. I was going to call it a Gaelic Artistic Association, but I think it's too long. I think Boland will be that. And I think that's, September, October time.
I think the lights were turned on in Boland's Mills for the first time in 100 years last night. So that's pretty interesting. Yeah, we used to live, the barge is literally, our barge looked out on it, and I watched for the last 4 years as it, you know, all the buildings came down around it and then just slowly risen up around it again, and they just worked away on Boland's Mills. It's so cool to see that restored. What book would you recommend, Paul?
The book that has probably had the biggest influence on me has been a dictionary book.
I love it.
I would recommend to everybody to own a dictionary.
That's brilliant.
I just find the dictionary really interesting and resourceful and educational. And I refer to it on my app on my phone mostly, but I have one liner. I have one around there somewhere as well. But I'll be on my dictionary app every day. I think that's not a bad recommendation. I just bought a book yesterday, the day before, called Soccermatics. It's about the relationship between mathematics and soccer in terms of across the board, from tactics to data. And it's a little heavy, but it's really interesting book as well. But I would say I would go for the dictionary if I had to give it.
Brilliant. What we'll do is we'll give them both away. We'll give a dictionary and Soccermatics away. What do they have to do to win? So if to tag myself, what do you want to be tagged on social media?
I guess my name, PGAL10 is my social media handle.
Super.
Instagram at PGAL10, I think, is probably the best way.
So yeah, just tag yourself, Mr. Gary Fox, and Paul on social media, and they can be given a chance to win.
Great.
Per, where can people follow you, actually? So it's PGAL10.
So it's Paul Galvin on Facebook. Paul Galvin on Facebook, at PGAL10 on Twitter and Instagram. And I've been on TikTok for about a year, but I don't operate on TikTok. I think it's a very interesting platform. It is proving there's a whole new young Irish guy on the way coming through that we need to make way for. And that's been an interesting observation, but I don't use it as a platform.
I'm the same. The dog has an account on it, but I just use the dog's one then to look at it. I find it fascinating. I'm literally going, geez, that was 20 minutes gone.
It's certainly, there's a lot happening on there that's informative, and dance and choreography has become a big thing for young Irishmen, which I think is really interesting, healthy, progressive.
I think you have to understand it. People are like, never take off. You have to understand these things. You can't just go, You can't be like that. You can't, then you stop growing. You stop learning, you stop growing. If you're that person, you're that our lad who's like, never take on, stupid. You have to understand. You have to at least have a grasp of what it is.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a healthy side to it too, from the point of view of a young man's self-esteem and self-confidence and kind of courage that he's actually, you know, listen, it's hip-hop and all that.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of, but listen, not long ago, that same girls, people pointing fingers and laughing and sneering at a guy doing a dance routine. Now guys are doing it as a matter of a daily recourse and exercise and fun and expression. And I think that's...
And building careers, brands, building themselves.
Building careers and building brands. And listen, I'm all for that, because it pushes the culture forward. And I think you can't deny that.
Love it. Paul, great lesson to end on. Thank you so much for taking the time to
chat. Thanks, Gary. Take care.
thank you for listening. That was this week's Entrepreneur Experiment. I'm sure you enjoyed that as much as I did. So if you want to win a copy of the two books that Paul mentioned there, including The Dictionary, which I absolutely love, as a suggestion, I'm going to grab a copy for myself this week and just keep it on my desk as a source of inspiration. Simply tag myself, Mr. Gary Fox, and Paul on social media. So you'll get us both on Twitter, Instagram. They're probably the best places to get us as we're most active. I'm also very active on LinkedIn as well. I will see you next week for the Entrepreneur Experiment. Have a great week.